Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. I was 18 and I had my life planned out. I was going to be a Broadway star. Since the age of 5, I performed on stage in musicals around my East Contra Costa community. When I was in middle and high school, I spent hours every day after school rehearsing. It was a no-brainer that I'd go into college to study musical theater. And at 18, that's exactly what I did. But within less than a year, I'd switched majors to a completely different branch of academics, women and gender studies. Why? Well, when I completed the freshman elective class in women's studies, I simply wanted more. After years and years of musical practice, my brain totally craved that change. And it's my degree in women's studies that then led me to public media, and now here I am, making radio and not singing. My friends were curious as to why I made such a big switch, because on paper, making a change in your life's path that seemingly negates all the work you put into it beforehand seems pretty dumb. But those surprising shifts happen to a lot of people, probably everyone at some point, though it most likely takes on different forms than trumping musical theater for intersectionality studies. In this episode of the podcast Neighbors, we'll meet a man who had an extraordinary childhood, but it's his perception of life now as an adult and the path he's chosen that makes my jaw drop. Neighbors host and producer Jacob Lewis has the story.
This story starts with a joke, one that it said every improviser knows. It's called 185.
185 blanks walk into a bar. The bartender says, "We don't serve blanks here." And the bartender all says, "Punchline," or the person going into the bar.
This is Lacey Madison. She's one of the teachers at the Nashville Improv Company. They do shows, teach classes, corporate events, things like that. They're in a rehearsal right now going over the game 185. There's about a dozen people standing in a line at the front of the room. And Lacey gives them an example audience suggestion.
185 elephants.
And someone bravely steps out and tells the first joke.
185 elephants walk into the bar, and the bartender says, "Well, we can't serve you here." And the elephants say, "Ah, peanuts."
Oh. 185 elephants walk into the bar, and the bartender says, "Oh, forget it." And the elephants say, "We can't."
185 elephants fly into the bar. The bartender goes, "Look, I don't serve flying elephants." And they go, "Well, that's Dumbo."
At the end of the line, a man with glasses steps out.
185 elephants walk into a bar because they heard there was a trunk sale.
This is Michael Carney. Now, you might not be able to tell it from that joke, but Michael is a genius improviser. I mean, he's an actual genius. What you're about to hear might be hard to believe, but when Michael was just a baby, he was pretty advanced.
Spoke at 4 months, was reading single words at 8 months, doing math at 2.
In fact, he graduated high school at 6. And according to my contact at the Guinness Book of World Records, Michael is officially the youngest person to graduate college at age 10 with a bachelor's degree in anthropology. And now at 32, he's not curing cancer or solving world hunger. No, he co-owns this improv company with Lacey, his longtime girlfriend, which turns out just might be the most genius move he could have made. I'm Jacob Lewis, and from Nashville Public Radio, you're listening to Neighbors, a show about what connects us. This is a story about a child prodigy who grew up and defied expectations, using his genius in an unconventional way. I went to Michael's house in Brentwood, Tennessee, the burbs of Nashville. In fact, his house actually looks like a soccer mom might live there.
Whoa. Hey.
Hi, come on in.
How's it going?
Oh, it's pretty good.
Michael and Lacey live here together. They have a baby grand piano in their front room, a giant TV in their living room, and about 50 board games haphazardly piled up in the corner. Michael takes me to a shelf and grabs a book to show me.
Here's this.
What's this?
This is me.
Oh. What is this book?
It's Time Magazine. Time Magazine was like, yep, super cute.
You are super cute.
That's Jay Leno.
It's a picture of 10-year-old Michael with giant glasses. He's being interviewed on The Tonight Show. It was a few days after he graduated college.
You know, so it's like, what do you do? Okay, you do.
What?
You get in Time magazine, you do that, you know.
Michael was born premature with blood poisoning. The doctors told his mother he would be developmentally delayed. He proved them wrong pretty quickly. At 8 months, he would look at the TV guide and let his parents know that The Price is Right is going to be on at 10. He was homeschooled at age 4 because he couldn't be put in public school until he was 5. They lived in California. He went through homeschooling pretty quickly.
I finished 5th through 9th grade in a year.
His parents knew he was ahead, but were anxious to get Michael into 1st grade in public school so he could be with other kids.
And basically the public school said, what, are you kidding? Are you kidding? No, you can't do that. He now is at the 9th grade level. You cannot put him into 1st grade. My parents were like, so what do you do? Well, there's a high school. And my parents were like, you can't put a 5-year-old in high school. That's insane. And they said, well, this high school has a program that works with teenage mothers, people getting their GEDs. It's a program called NOVA. And they said, what you do is you enroll your student into the high school, but they're actually taking classes through NOVA. It's the part of my story that probably makes the best 80s sitcom. Everybody there, it's like, you know, okay, well, it's a 14-year-old girl with a baby, and then a 70-year-old, you know, Army veteran, and then me.
Michael did take 2 classes at the high school to get the student experience, algebra and French. He got reprimanded for correcting his algebra teacher's test, but he still graduated high school at the whopping age of 6, having to cite Little League as his PE credit.
So at the end of that, it was like, okay, well, what's next? And I remember my dad, like, you know, laughingly go, I guess college, right? And then everybody got quiet. We all kind of looked and we went, oh, crap.
He gets his associate's degree at 8 and then decides he wants a bachelor's. You might think it would be easy for a child prodigy to get into college, but that wasn't the case.
I got a lot of different, hilarious rejection letters. One that literally told me to get a social life. I'm literally the only student whose social life you are prying into. And I was like, do you want signed affidavits from my friends saying, hey, Michael's really good at Mortal Kombat 2? Because I was like, I can show you my high scores, bro.
His family ended up moving to Mobile, Alabama, because his dad was in the Navy. In Mobile, there was the University of South Alabama.
They had a really, really progressive dean, a guy who just came in and he was like, we're going to shake everything up. The president was like, yeah, we're going to shake everything up. So the president said, if we get this kid and this works, we will be nationally known.
So they say, as long as Michael survives his first semester, they'll give him a full ride.
There was only one problem, though. The first day of school, there were 5 newspapers, 4 television networks, and 5 radio stations in the class.
And this was the beginning of Michael's media attention. People started to recognize him around town. And one day, he was in a supermarket in Alabama, and something happened that changed the course of Michael's life.
A dude looked at me and he goes, hey, what you're doing is real good. Here's a $20 bill. And I was like, I have no idea who that man was. He just walked up and he was like, here's a $20 bill. And I was like,
Michael thought, hey, this is fun. So he turned to his parents and asked,
is it entirely okay if I exploit my fame?
They agreed, as long as he kept up with school. So they started taking on more media requests. One of the first was a talk show in Seattle.
It was called Northwest Afternoon, I believe. Just the most generico, like, talk show you could ever imagine. It had that like sexy saxophone music. Hey, welcome back to Northwest Africa, dude. We'll have to go to that, you know? And I was like, oh, so people will fly you places?
In a way, he was working the system. Child Genius makes headlines. Child Genius uses headlines to get free steak dinners all over the country.
There wasn't a talk show that I haven't done. I mean, I didn't do David Letterman, I didn't do Conan, and I didn't do Ricky Lake. Everything else. All of them.
Now, all this time, Michael was still in school. And eventually came graduation day.
June 5th, 1994. Hundreds of news organizations just packed the Mobile Civic Center. And I'm just, you know, okay, let's walk up there. I walked up there and was deafened.
He got a massive half-minute standing ovation. Graduating at 10 was a record-breaking achievement that you think would go a long way for Michael, but turns out really didn't matter when it came to the real world.
So my bachelor's degree was in anthropology, cultural anthropology. Well, cultural anthropology eventually means that you go to a tribe or you go to, you know, do research on far-off cultures, except that you can't do that when you're 12 or 11 or 10. So that's not going to happen. So I was like, well, okay, I have a degree in this. What is the point in which I'd get to use it? And they were like, 18. I was like, I'm 10. What do I do? Yeah, yeah, you're great. You're smart. You're wonderful. But no one's going to take you seriously. You know, it's a goon show. I'm gonna use the media. I'm gonna use it and get a chance to like be a famous child.
So Michael went back to the thing that was the most fun for him, the entertainment business.
They offered me a Disney TV movie of the week
with Melissa Joan Hart.
It's called Family Reunion: A Relative Nightmare.
Look, I get the complete mint stamp collection of the Elvis commemorative.
He played the nerdy cousin, which was a typical role for him.
The thing I didn't really realize until a lot later was that all of the guys that were the most entertaining and the guys I was having the most fun with, hanging out with, was the guys who were trained at Second City or the Groundlings.
These are two improv schools.
I would learn, you know, from what they were doing. What they were doing was just being positive, being friendly, and they were positive to everyone. So I kind of took that to heart. And I was like, oh, great. This is what, that's the style of like acting. That's the side of like my personality that I want to do.
Michael was enthralled with game shows from an early age. He thought, why not try and host one? So his parents flew him to LA where he started his own TV pilot. It was called Split Second. But the network canceled it because they thought people wouldn't like seeing a kid correct adults. So, slightly dejected, Michael went back to get a master's in chemistry. And at graduation, there was a reporter, asked him what he'd like to do next.
And since I'm 14, I can pretty much do whatever I want. I don't have, you know, time constraints, or I don't have to get a job, certainly. So I can take a little while to think about that.
Michael did get another degree. He even taught some, but he still craved the fun of being in entertainment. And at 21 years old, there came the thrill of a lifetime. A perfect melding of his genius and TV experience.
Actress Sandra Bullock recently married what bad boy? Michael?
Jesse James.
Bad boy host of TV's Monster Garage, Jesse James is the answer. Michael, you are a millionaire.
Michael won $1 million on a game show called Gold Rush. He was interviewed on CBS News about the win.
But now here's the question. You have all this amazing education. Well, how come you're so good at pop culture?
Well, the thing is that when you graduate college at a really young age, you have nothing better to do sometimes. You just kind of sit around because you don't have a lot of school to go to. So I sat around and watched a lot of TV, a lot of movies.
You're sending a bad message to the youth of America this morning.
I am. I'm sending a bad message. Everybody should sit in front of their TV and then sit in front of their computer. Gold Rush.
That's right. Mark Steinitz, what do you think set Michael apart from the rest of these contestants? Because you had some really sharp people.
Well, he was really intense when he came in to play the game. My concern really, Harry, is he's just peaked way too early in life, you know? He's got everything. I don't know. Where does he go from here? Where do you go from here? I mean, I don't know.
What do you do for an encore? Exactly right.
If you ever watched the movie Little Man Tate, Little Man Tate is about a child prodigy who fails at life, and he doesn't understand the world. And it's about, no matter how smart you are, people can't really, they can't connect to real life. You know, that's what Doogie Howser MD was all about.
So the child prodigy grows up. And everyone that I've talked to about this all has the same question, the same point of tension. And it has to do with expectations. We stand in awe of prodigies, but we expect and almost demand that they use those gifts on behalf of the world. And at the same time, extremely intelligent people make us feel inferior and insecure, so we keep them at a distance. It's a lose-lose. Up until now, there might not be anything that you can relate to in Michael's story. Kid who had it all, brains, fame, and now money. But you might be able to relate to this next part.
In my early 20s, I had a bad breakup, and I think that's traditionally when people start in improv.
Michael found an improv class in Nashville. He took it for a while, and he started to have some serious fun, and with a group of friends that was really dedicated. One of these friends was Lacey. And after about 5 years of being part of classes, the owner of the company decided he didn't want to run it anymore. And rather than let its doors go shut, Michael and his new girlfriend Lacey took it over.
Ah, William Wallace, you think we can go to the labeling bar and go to the new hire?
Are you? I
Let's show our butts.
We always say improv is not a cult. It's totally a cult. It's not a cult. But it is. It's all the things that make a cult good without all of the weird, terrible religious overtones. You can still engage all the parts of you that are a giant trust fall. So you're like having fun, you're engaged with people you don't know, and you're in a place in which you can succeed or fail, but all of those things in the group setting are successes.
Michael could have devoted his life to doing math problems for the human race, but it just wasn't his style.
That strive really wasn't for me, because at the end of that, it's like climbing that ladder to the loneliest spot in the ivory tower. Great, you're at the top, and you will be there. You will be the only guy who is there, and now no one can talk to you. I just happened to find a thing that I could be very good at, I could work at, you know, in improv that happens to be something that to be really good at it, you have to be really nice. And to be really good at it, you have to be really friendly. And to be really good at it, you have to be good at listening to other people. Oh, so to be really good at improv, you have to be a really decent human. Great. That sounds like my thing. God, I'm so tired from teaching improv. I'm so tired of laughing.
And if somebody in the audience throws something out in hopes of challenging us, if it has anything to do with chemistry or art, he's there. He's like, oh, you want a deep art joke about Rembrandt? He will go there. It's really fun to watch. So we all have different talents, and improv gets to bring all of those out.
So is Michael squandering his gift, or is he using it to build a community of decent humans? I think it's the latter, and it was in the environment he created that I was prompted, in a somewhat uncharacteristic move, to bust out a joke in front of everyone about 185 backpacks.
185 backpacks walk into a bar. The bartender says, "We don't serve backpacks here." And the backpack says, "Ah!" And the bartender goes, "Zip it!" I'll get out of your hair.
The podcast Neighbors is from Nashville Public Radio. Jacob Lewis is the show's host and producer. Though Neighbors features stories from communities in the greater Nashville area, it's a show that's firmly rooted in the universal experiences and emotions that connect all of us. Hear what I mean by subscribing on Stitcher, iTunes, or Google Play. Or just head to their website, neighborsaudioshow.com. You're tuned to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Improv performers willingly choose to enter a space where nothing is planned out, and where mind and body have to work together to resolve obstacles and present new ones to your team, and then somehow it all has to end in a cohesive point. I love seeing it done well. It's so smooth and delightful and satisfying. But I know that improvisation in my day-to-day life looks nothing like that. It's dealing with a car that won't start when I'm already late for a DJ gig. It's getting the late night phone call from my mother that my dad's in an ambulance. The moments and hours immediately after is a bumbling parade of me trying to rewrite what's going to happen next, but without any of the grace or support of improv performers. We're all making it up as we go along, especially in those moments when life hands you a real curveball. You have no choice but to roll with it. Or in this case, try to sing along.
I was injected on March the 4th, 2005. The rainbow is a division of white light into many beautiful colors. These take the shape of a long round arch with its path high above and its two ends apparently beyond the horizon. I will say E for a long time. We mow our lawn all year. We eat apples and eggs. The puppy bit the tape.
Lee Ellen Shoemaker isn't losing her mind.
Sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray.
She's losing her voice.
You'll never know, dear, how much I love you.
Please, what you just heard is one of the vocal exercises Lee Ellen records every day for her doctor. A few years ago, she came down with a rare neurological condition called spasmodic dysphonia.
I remember when this first happened. The weird thing about it was, even though I couldn't speak, I could sing. I said, well, I can talk good enough, but if I couldn't sing, I don't know what I would do.
Shoemaker calls herself the tunnel singer. She's what you might call acoustically obsessed. She spends a lot of time looking for echoey places to sing.
When I was very young, we had a coal bin in our cellar that was empty. And I loved to go down there and just make sounds. And anytime I would be in a space that I could hear something different, I had to test it out. I was on jury duty one time, and in the Hall of Justice, there are these long marble halls. In the parking garage near the hospital where I worked, a 7-story stairwell. When I became unable to sing, it really, really was hard. I've tried so many alternative therapies.
She tried voice rest, hormonal supplements, biofeedback. Nothing really worked. Until finally, Shoemaker went to a speech pathologist who correctly diagnosed her condition. What actually happens is that the vocal cords go into involuntary spasms.
The spasms will sometimes intensify. If I just do something to break the pattern, like, if I laugh like that, my voice will come back. If I pat myself on the head, if I do weird things with my hands, my voice will get strong again.
I love that laughing makes your voice come back.
Yeah, it's better than crying, right?
The standard treatment for spasmodic dysphonia is Botox. It temporarily paralyzes muscles. So when Botox is injected into the larynx, it stops the spasms. We're in the office of Dr. Mark Khoury of the University of California, San Francisco Medical Center.
Now, I have to figure out how to get a slightly better view of your vocal cords.
So, picture the scene. Lee Ellen is sitting in a chair, kind of like a dental chair. Dr. Khoury is holding a tiny camera mounted on a curved rod that's pointing down her throat. We can see an image of Shoemaker's larynx and the pink tissue surrounding it, pulsing, projected onto a video screen. It's kind of weird, but also fascinating.
You're going to lean forward for me. Mm-hmm. You're going to stick your tongue out. You're going to hold on to it right here and just bring it forward. I'm going to take this here.
The next thing that happens is Dr. Khoury takes a syringe that's filled with local anesthetic and drips it down Shoemaker's throat onto her vocal folds.
Ah.
Ah.
Say, we mow our lawn all year.
We mow our lawn all year.
It takes a few tries.
We eat apples and eggs.
We eat apples and eggs.
Perfect.
Once she's numb, he then injects the Botox with a long, curved needle. It's not an easy process for either of them. At one point, I can hear Shoemaker sort of croaking, chocolate milkshake. So afterwards, I take her out for one.
You get the injection, you pass through a period of good voice because the paralysis starts, but then you go past that point and more gets more paralyzed. And then it starts coming back. But then you have a period of hopefully about 3 to 4 months of good voice. And then the spasms start again.
It's Saturday, the day after her Botox treatment, and we're up at the Marin Headlands tunnel testing her voice.
We don't know whether I'll be able to regain my voice again. There's just something so personally rewarding to be able to stand in a tunnel. It's a very transformative experience for me. Being able to use my voice always was a huge part of how I saw myself.
Have you had dreams about singing since you haven't been able to?
Yes, I sing a lot in my dreams. In fact, I can hit notes in my dreams that I never could hit when I was awake. You know, the funny thing about it is when I dream that I'm singing, when I wake up, I don't feel at all disappointed. I feel like I actually did it, and it's that same kind of feeling of peace and satisfaction.
That profile was produced by Catherine Girardot with Earprint Productions. Singer Lee Ellen Shoemaker is local to San Francisco, and you can find more of her music at tunnelsinger.com. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Look for The Spot under the Programs tab. And tune in next Sunday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on 91.7 KALW, San Francisco.